Since this is Memorial Day weekend, I wasn't sure as how many people would show up, and we've had a pretty good turnout on a Memorial Day weekend. But oftentimes people ask, well, what did you learn by going to Israel and Greece? And so I thought I'd share a little bit of that with you today. This is not going to be like watching somebody's holiday vacation slides, believe me. There are going to be a lot of really great insights, I hope, for you. Because what I think is so interesting is that we can, when we go to Israel, and if you never have a chance to go to Israel, I'm going to mention some books, or go to Greece, some other books that would be very helpful to you for you to read. But there are a lot of insights that come from walking the land and kind of going where Jesus was. And I even had a conversation with one of the guides and even one of the pastors who was involved with us. You've got to think about the fact that most of the great hymns that we sing in church every once in a while were written in the 18th or the 19th or even the early part of the 20th century. And they were written by people that had never been to Israel because it was controlled by the Ottoman Empire. And so when we sing about a hill on Calvary, first of all, there's no hill. And second of all, Jesus was not crucified on a hill on Calvary. We're going to talk about a lot of other ones along the way. And you realize that some of this has been perpetuated by Hollywood and the way in which they did films. And some of it has come from people who would never walk the land and did not see some of the connections. Even some of the Bible commentaries written that I have on my Logos software, written in the 18th or 19th centuries, you know, Matthew Henry and all the way back to Spurgeon, people like that. These are individuals that weren't there in the land. And so I want to share with you, if you will permit me, and we're going to do a little bit of a sword drill today because we're going to, as you can see in the handout here, looking at various Bible passages and try to see if maybe there's some things that we can learn. And so if that's of interest to you, you might want to take some notes as we go along. But the first one is we're going to take you to Caesarea. And so if you have a Bible, turn with me to Acts chapter 10 real quickly. And here we have a situation where Peter, up until now, has really been preaching and teaching amongst the Jewish people. And now he is taken to this particular place, which is called Caesarea. Now, this was actually a Roman outpost. As you go there, and some of us in the class have been there either in the first trip or the second trip, it's very Roman. It's not Israeli at all, because it was an attempt to really have a place where those who came from Italy, those who came from Rome, felt comfortable. They'd be really homesick if they were in Jerusalem. And this is really where the leaders were. And we're going to see, first of all, here that Peter has a vision, and that's in verse 9 and about the sixth hour. And it tells him to rise and go up. And so he now is going to Cornelius. You see this in verse 17. And Cornelius is one of the centurions there in Caesarea. And so here is an opportunity for him to now understand that God is expanding the gospel to more than just to the Jews, because he is taking Peter to a place he probably had never been before, and that is a Roman garrison, a Roman outpost. And you can see from the picture here that there is a theater. There at one point was a harbor that was built there by Herod the Great. And so as a result, this is where a great deal of Roman activity takes place, but now Cornelius and his family come to know the Lord, and this is the beginning of spreading the gospel to the Gentile nations. And so as we go there, we see all sorts of things. As a matter of fact, we see, you can also turn over to Acts 24, and here we see this is some place where Paul ends up later, and he makes his presentation before Festus, before Felix, and before King Agrippa. And this is most likely the prison in which he was held right there on the plain. So we can actually see where Peter was and where Paul was. And so there are some great significant elements of this, because we were able to be there and to actually see what it looked like. But there's something else that was very interesting that came out of Caesarea, and it's found on this particular plaque. This actually is a record of Pontius Pilate. Now, that archaeological find was very helpful, because up until when this was found, relatively recently, we had reason to believe there probably was a Pontius Pilate, but most of the reason we believed it was because of what the Bible has to say. Now, as we're going to see today, there's a couple of times where people even question whether the Bible is accurate. I don't think there were that many people that questioned whether or not there was a Pontius Pilate, but it's nice to have independent archaeological verification, and this is a copy of the one that actually is in the Israeli Museum, but that's the one that's right there in Caesarea. And what we are going to find time and time again as we go through this morning is that sometimes people have wondered whether or not the Bible's a record is true and have raised questions about it. Especially when we come to Luke, as we go to where Paul walked, there are all sorts of questions that people have asked about, well, did Luke accurately represent the history of Paul? And one of the things that has just come out in a new book that I would certainly commend to individuals is a book that an individual by the name of Frank Turek has put out. And just in the appendix here, he has 84, although I now can add two more because I found them on the trip, 86, we'll use the 84 here, various details that are in the book of Acts or in the Gospel of Luke that have been now verified by archaeology. And it used to be that skeptics would say, well, Luke is saying this, but this is not how we understand history. And then we'll find through historical records or archaeology to find out that, no, the skeptics are wrong and the Bible was right. And so if you do apologetics like I like to do, certainly there are some great stories that come out of this and I think can reconfirm the historical accuracy of what we find in the New Testament. So let's, if we can, maybe go to the Old Testament, because right near where Caesarea is a place known as Mount Carmel. And Mount Carmel, very important, as we can see here, because if we go to 1 Kings, verse 18, we see this is the place where, indeed, we have the confrontation between Ahab and Elijah. Now, this is in the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, when we look at the kings of Israel in the northern kingdom, were these good kings or bad kings? They were all bad kings, weren't they? And Ahab is listed as the worst of the worst. And so we have in 1 Kings 18, you might look at some of the reaction from verses 11 and following, where here Elijah tells Obadiah to go to King Ahab and tell him that they're ready to meet. And Obadiah is saying, wait a minute. Verse 13, has it not been told, my Lord, that what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, how I hid hundreds of men of the Lord's prophets by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water? In other words, you don't want me going to Ahab. He's going to kill me because I've been protecting some of these other prophets that were not killed by Ahab. Ahab and Jezebel, not so really good, obviously. So when they finally meet, we see this in verse 17, when Ahab sees Elijah, Ahab said to him, is it you, you troubler of Israel? Now, who's the good king or the bad king? Who are the good guys and the bad guys? Well, Ahab is the bad guy, and yet he's referring to Elijah as the bad guy, which I think illustrates a very interesting point in all of this, and that is sometimes even when you're doing the right thing, people will call you bad. And so here we are on the top of Mount Carmel, looking out over this particular plain. Matter of fact, I think I have a picture. There's a picture there of the statue of Elijah eventually killing out those prophets of Baal. And if you think about what this is like, here he has got all these prophets of Baal. He's one guy, got 300 of one, 300 of another, 200, 450 another. I mean, there are all sorts of people, but yet he's a majority with God. And so here, of course, we are talking about this particular action that takes place in Mount Carmel. But it also overlooks this plain, and this is called the Jezreel Valley. Now, in the book of Revelation, it also talks about a battle that will be fought there, and it's the battle of what? Armageddon. Now, Har means Mount. Megiddo would be the Mount of Megiddo, but there's no Mount of Megiddo. There's no Mount Megiddo. There's a Megiddo, yes, but there's no Mount Megiddo. So the only mount really is this one, Mount Carmel. But this is, of course, the plain, and you can see how broad it is. When Napoleon came here at that time, he said, you know, this would be a great place where a battle could be fought, and you could fit all of the armies of the world into that plain. So in the Old Testament, this is where you see Elijah fights what? The prophets of Baal. And this had never occurred to me before, because in the prophets of Baal, he is calling them to bring their God to actually burn the sacrifice. And at one point by noontime, he's getting a little bit frustrated with them, and he starts having a little bit of a question. Verse 27, at noon, Elijah mocked them by saying, cry aloud, for he is a God. Either he is musing, or don't you love this, or your God is relieving himself. or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened. But eventually what happens is that right here, God brings fire from heaven and destroys the sacrifice. And then Elijah cleans them up. When I was here, I never saw this. In the book of Revelation, it tells us that the beast of the Antichrist will call down what? Fire from heaven. So in the same place, the Antichrist in the false way will try to mimic what Elijah did in the Old Testament. So it's kind of interesting to see how now in these latter days during the tribulation, when those of us in church believe in pre-tribulation rapture, we are all gone, right? That there will be a miracle that the beast and the Antichrist will call down fire from heaven just as Elijah did in that place in the Old Testament. And so I thought that was kind of an interesting insight. You know, if that doesn't ring your bell, let's see if we can come up with a couple more, because I found that these are really kind of great insights to begin to realize what was taking place there. And so turn with me, if you might, now to John chapter 6. We're going to spend a little bit of time now in the Gospels and really kind of follow the story of Jesus, because in John chapter 6, we come to the town of Capernaum. This is known really as the town of Jesus. You know, if you'd ask a lot of people where Jesus was from, you'd say what? Nazareth, okay? Where was he born? Bethlehem. By the way, remember this in just a minute. What does Bethlehem mean? It's the house of bread. We're going to come back to that in just a minute. But the place where Jesus spends most of his time is Capernaum. And we know exactly what that looks like. That is actually a synagogue that was built on top of the synagogue where Jesus actually ministers. Now turn with me, if you would, to John chapter 6. And you see that it begins with something that happens on the other side of the Sea of Galilee on the northern part, and that is where he is feeding 5,000 people. Now, before he does so, it's interesting that he asks Philip a question. Look at verse 5. He turns to Philip and says, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" Now, if you think about it, Philip doesn't get a lot of press in the New Testament. Peter does, John does. Philip really doesn't. So why in the midst of all of that does Jesus ask Philip this question? Well, it turns out that where this miracle took place was just about a mile or two. Well, when I'm over there, they always talk about kilometers. So 2 kilometers from Bethsaida. And where was Philip from? Bethsaida. In other words, what he's saying is, Philip, you're from the nearby town. How many bakery shops do we have here so that we could actually feed all these people? And of course, Philip is like, he answers, it would take 200 denarii, would not be enough bread for each of them just to get a little. So first of all, we don't have enough money, but more to the point, there's not enough bread in Bethsaida to feed these people, even if we had the money to go in there and buy that. Because Jesus is, of course, setting up what? The miracle. So that's kind of an insight where you see where they fed the 5,000, you realize where he's from, and you understand now why Jesus asked Philip that question. Then from there, after he's fed all the people, let's go over to verse 16, we see that now he sends the disciples off, and then he decides to join them, but he doesn't join them in a boat, he's just walking on the water. And so now we bring us to where we are, and that is Capernaum. And that is, you can see that now he has arrived here, verse 24, that the boats and went to Capernaum seeking Jesus. Now this crowd has not been able to be in the boats, but they've walked around the top end of the Sea of Galilee, and they're saying, let's go to Capernaum. This guy is definitely what we've always wanted. This is welfare in the best possible way. When I'm hungry, he brings us bread. So they all show up looking for bread. And he even confronts them that as well, saying that, when Jesus saw them, we see that you are seeking me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. The implication is you're looking to me for more bread. Now, the way to probably illustrate the rest of this particular passage is to think that he's just the opposite of Dale Carnegie. Remember Dale Carnegie wrote a book? What was the name of that? How to Win Friends and Influence People. Well, this sermon could be entitled, How to Lose Disciples and Turn the Card Against You, because he first of all begins to say, you want bread, but here we see that I am the bread of life, which also harkens all the way back to Bethlehem. And then he begins to challenge the disciples, the Pharisees and scribes, and whereas he had thousands of people following him, pretty soon as we go through the Gospel of John, it's just a handful of disciples. And so again, when we're in Capernaum, we see a little bit of how close that town was. And this is something that's kind of striking. Some of you may have grown up in a small town. You know, some of you say, well, the town was so small that the entering the town and leaving the town were almost back to back, right? Well, this is a pretty small town because this is indeed Capernaum. The part that I showed you there is the synagogue that was built on top of the synagogue where Jesus was. So the white is the synagogue where Jesus was. The black is the part above. And in that synagogue, you realize that it's a really small area, and not more than, I'd say about 50 yards, is this, and that's the home of Peter. Now, we don't know for sure it's the home of Peter, but the early church believed that it was. It's the only place where you have Christian symbols and you have fishhooks. It was kind of the house church in Capernaum, and there's a lot of reason to believe that it was his home. So we have the actual home of Peter as well, and all the plaster that was there. Eventually, the house and the home was turned into the early first century church. And so you can see how close all of that was. And so you can also answer another question, because when Jesus is, we see this in the other Gospels, healing. Remember, he heals Simon Peter's mother-in-law? What happens? Well, the whole crowd was there at the house by evening because word spreads pretty quickly. Those of you that come from a small town, you know what you talk about. I remember going to small towns sometimes where over dinner everybody talks about what's happening in everybody's house, right? And everybody, word spreads very quickly. Well, now you realize that because this town was abandoned, the town of Jesus is still pretty much like it was when Jesus was there. And you can pretty much see where the fishing boats were. You can see where the house was. You can see where the synagogue was. And of course, this is where, of course, he begins to challenge those who were coming to him simply because they wanted more bread. Let's turn to the left to Matthew, and we'll go to Matthew chapter 16 and look at a really famous passage here. And the point I'm making, first of all, here is that Jesus now takes Peter and the other disciples to Caesarea Philippi. And so Matthew 16, verse 13, you see, now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked the disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? Well, to understand that, you have to recognize that Caesarea Philippi was a pagan area to the north. It's almost in present-day Lebanon. This is a place where very few people have ever been because it was always controlled either by the Lebanese or by the Syrians. But, of course, now it has opened up to give us a chance to see what it looks like. And here's one of the pictures of it. You will see that this actually is, interestingly enough, water coming right out of the rock. It's just a spring that literally comes right out of the rock, water coming from Mount Hermon nearby. And you'll see some of those holes. I'm going to show what those are in just a minute. Because in the midst of this, of course, Jesus asks, who do you say that I am? And so they say, well, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter replied, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood have not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Now, what about this statement here? He makes a couple of statements. First of all, he says, you are Peter, and then you are the rock. He's having a word play here, Petros and Petros. And the point is that they are standing before this huge rock wall. And what it looked like in that time was you have these temples. You have the temple over here to Apollos, one to Zeus, and one to Pan. Now, Pan was the Greek god at that time. So they're standing where there is this huge rock face. You've got to wonder, and Gary Fraser suggests that maybe even picks up a rock and said, Peter, you are the small rock. But you are actually this rock. You are the foundation. And they're standing in a place that they've never been before. Peter has never been there. This is a pagan area. Jews would not go there. But yet again, once again, trying to help them understand that the gospel is going to go not just to the Jews, but is going to go to even these pagans who are presently worshiping Pan and presently worshiping Zeus. We're going to take the gospel to the entire world. Then he makes another statement about the gates of hell. Well, you see that hole there? It's probably better to see in the back one. You see that big hole there? Okay, and over here, between those temples, was considered to be the gates of hell. They believe it's the reason they believed it is it was an open area, and it drops all the way down. They never could find the bottom of it. Now, there's been an earthquake since then that's filled in some of that. But they actually, when they were involved in human sacrifice, sometimes would throw a child down there to appease the gods, or in many cases, they would throw an animal down there, and they would never hear it hit. It's just one of those drops. So they believe that that was the gates to hell. So again, when Peter is standing there in front of this rock face, in front of what's known as the gates of hell, where you have these great temples, Jesus is saying to him, you think you're this rock. You are really this. And even the gates of hell will not prevail against you. And until you go there, you don't understand why Jesus uses the phrase gates of hell. They're standing before what they believed at the time were the gates, the very gates to hell. And you can see how, in some respects, going and seeing the geography really helps answer some of the questions about what Jesus was saying is the time. Does that make sense? And those are some things you get just by simply going there. Let's now, if we can, go to, again, the Old Testament. And we'll go to 1 Samuel 24. And this is now in the southern part of Israel in a place called En-Gedi. Now, En-Gedi is actually a place of oasis in the midst of a very desolate area. We're down here by the Dead Sea. We're down here by the Judean wilderness. We're down in a really dry, hot area. But again, out of the rock comes this water. And you begin to see these beautiful waterfalls in the midst of it and very lush area developing. And in En-Gedi, we see now in verse 24, this is where David went to flee from Saul. And we see this in chapter 24, verse 1. When Saul returned from following the Philistines, he told, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of Israel, went to seek David and the men in front of the wild goat's rock. En-Gedi, En means spring, Gedi means goat, and the reason for that is you have these Nubian ibex there, and so the area is known as En-Gedi, and it's full of goats, and also these little rock hyraxes there. And so this is a place where, indeed, David finds himself trying to flee from Saul. Well, if you're familiar with the story, and we'll go into all the details here, at one point they are hiding in the caves, and there are all a number of caves in here. Matter of fact, I even sent people out to go figure out which cave they thought David and his men were. And we, of course, read the story that at one point Saul decides to go into a cave and, again, to use that phrase, relieve himself. So they're in the back of the cave, and Saul comes in. And at this point, David's associates are saying, God has put him into your hands. Just take out your knife, kill him, and we're done with this. But instead, David, as you know, cuts off part of his robe. He goes on back out, and at this point then, David uses this to show that he is indeed, does not mean Saul any harm. And he comes out, verse 9, he says, and called after Saul, my Lord and my King. And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the earth and paid homage. And David said to Saul, why do you listen to the words of men who say, behold, David seeks your harm. Behold, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave me today into your hand, and some told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not put out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand, for by the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. And so he's holding up the actual cloth, part of the robe, to say, I could have taken your life and did not do so. Now, again, there's a question that comes from this. David's a little bit bold, because if you read that, you sort of think that David just walks out. Saul's here, there are 3,000 men, and he holds us up. And if Saul doesn't change his mind, he is what? Dead, right? Well, this is one time where I think Hollywood got it right. There were a number of years ago, there was a movie that came out called David. Now, Richard Gere played David. You got to work a little bit to try to make him David, okay? But there is a scene in which he's standing on the top of this area, speaking down to Saul, and once you see where this is and you put that in with the movie, that makes a whole lot more sense. That is, he crawls out of the cave, he takes his men up, he's in the top here, and he's shouting down to Saul, and if Saul decides to go after him, there the only way they can do is go all the way back out and come up around. By that time, David's, you know, gone. And so you begin to realize that he is able to shout down to him. But at the same time, he's protected. If Saul doesn't change his mind, they figure out how to head upstream long before those 3,000 men could ever have caught him. And so again, it begins to answer, I think, a kind of a question about, was David being kind of foolhardy at this point, standing in front of him, wondering whether or not there's a spear coming flying at him 2 seconds after he makes that statement? At the same time, it also helps us understand a little bit more about what it must have been like to have been running from Saul all those years, to actually live in the cave. If you see it, look in some of those caves, you realize they don't have porta potties, and you realize there are all sorts of other things you're dealing with. There are also snakes there. There is the Palestinian viper, which is really one of the worst in the world. So you recognize this was not exactly an idyllic set of circumstances that David put himself through. And also, of course, you see the tremendous overkill, because as we just read a minute ago, how many people did Saul have coming against David? 3,000. And you look, these 3,000 must just line this area. There's a couple of waterfalls preceding that and behind it, but you recognize that they must have just almost completely filled the canyon. David and his men fit into one of those caves, and you recognize he probably couldn't have had more than 24 men. So he brings 3,000 men against a dozen or 24 men. And it shows you a little bit more of the overkill which was taking place. Well, in the interest of time, let's move on, and we'll go to Jerusalem. A couple of things that I thought were kind of intriguing about this, and that is, let's go back to the Gospel of John now. We'll see a couple of the miracles that Jesus performs. But one of those miracles that he performs is actually, interestingly enough, at the pool of Bethesda. And Bethesda means mercy. Matter of fact, it's not surprising that to the very day we have the National Institute of Health, which is located at what? Bethesda, Maryland. And this is a particular case where, again, we now have that pool of Bethesda. I'll show you a picture looking down on it. First of all, this is where this actually takes place. This is the St. Anne's Church, and that's the reconstruction there of where the pool is. And also it answers a question that skeptics have always had, because it talks about the fact that there were 5 roofed colonnades and 2 different pools. Well, until they uncovered that, people said, that may not be accurate. Well, it turns out it is. We actually have 2 pools and we have 5 colonnades. Why 5? 5 is the biblical number for mercy and grace. And we're going to see now that God, through Jesus Christ, extends grace to this man who was paralyzed and lame. What I think is so interesting when we look at that particular area, look at verse 6. Jesus sees him and asks him the question, do you want to be healed? Well, that's a kind of a silly question, isn't it? Do you want to be healed? I think the answer is, well, yes, that's why I'm sitting here at this pool of Bethesda. I'm really hoping that I could throw myself in while the water's being stirred and maybe I'll be healed. Probably just a folk tale. Probably nobody was actually healed. But nevertheless, the sick man doesn't say yes or no. He just simply says, well, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up while I was going another steps in beyond before them. So at this point, Jesus simply says, get up. Take up your bed and walk. Now, you would think that would be a great thing, right? Well, not for the Pharisees and the Sadducees, because this was the day of the Sabbath, and now, of course, they are criticizing him because he is walking. He then explains that it was actually Jesus who actually told him to do so. And we see probably one of the best direct claims to deity by Jesus in verse 17. But Jesus answered them, my Father is working until now, and I am working. And verse 18 shows they understood that, because it says, this is why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was all even calling God his own father, making himself what? Equal to God. And so again, if you look down into the reconstruction, you can see that's the portion of this. You might say, why haven't they taken all of it out? Well, they'd have to knock down about 3 dozen houses to actually uncover the rest of the Pool of Bethesda, but at least we've been able to see enough of it to actually see where that miracle took place. Another one we see just by going just a few other pages to the right, and this one is taking place now in the temple steps. These are the southern steps to the temple, which takes place right there. And this is a place which, first of all, we know, when some people want to say, are we sure Jesus walked here? Yes, because this was the entrance into the temple in the south part. This is where John, Peter, Matthew, all of them walked through here. As we're going to see in just a minute, is also where the day of Pentecost took place as well. But here we see in verse 9 here, a man who is born blind. Intriguing, because there is no record of anybody born blind who was healed in the Old Testament. And yet if you go back and catalog all of the miracles, Jesus probably healed more people, at least recorded in the scriptures, who were blind and now were able to see. And of course, he has already talked about he's the bread of life. Now he's going to talk about what? That I'm the light of the world, that you will be able to see light. And so, of course, the question is, first of all, asked by his disciples, verse 3, was it the man who sinned or his parents who sinned? And he answers, no, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Look at that. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I'm the world, I am the light of the world. And now he heals this individual. And of course, we went through this talk about what this man must have been thinking. He's been blind. Jesus is now going to heal him. But the first thing he hears is, because he takes some dirt and he spits in his hand, takes some, and puts mud in his face. You might say, why did he do that? Well, it turns out that the Jewish people actually used to believe that the saliva of a firstborn actually would heal you. But then when they learned that pagan people use saliva, they actually rejected that idea. So Jesus is sort of poking his finger in their chest a little bit, saying, okay, I'll actually take something you used to believe was true, something you now that believe only pagans can, and of course he is healed. And then once again, we see that this individual is now brought before the Pharisees, because once again, Jesus does this what? On the Sabbath. I think he did these intentionally just to show that he was the Lord of the Sabbath. And of course, we see what actually takes place there as well. Now, not only is this a place, interestingly enough, where Jesus performed many of his miracles, where Jesus actually was healing individuals, probably where Jesus was sitting when he was watching the widow put her widow's mite into the offering, but it is also most likely the place where Peter stood on the day of Pentecost and actually preached a gospel message. But that raises a very good question that only is answered when you go there. And it only occurred to us when we went to Israel last time. Because if you look at the book of Acts, how many people became Christians on the day of Pentecost? 3,000. What happens next? They were baptized. Where are they baptized? There's no running water there. There is no stream. You are really far away from water until you look at this. There's what is known as these ritual baths, known as mikvahs. And those mikvahs are located right there. There are steps down into the water. You literally take off all your clothes. You step down into the water. Then you step back out, and you are now purified and allowed to go into the temple. Well, these mikvahs are all located around the southern steps of the temple. So I think that answers the question. When Peter preaches and 3,000 come to know the Lord, it tells us in the next verse that they were baptized. We're going, how? Well, everybody at that day knew it, but it only occurs to you later when you're there. They all were going down into those ritual baptized, and they were being baptized in the mikvahs, in those ritual baths right there on the steps of the temple. Pretty interesting, huh? Oh, a couple more real quickly. We won't look at our scriptures on this one, but that is to look at the Mount of Olives. And when you especially go to the Garden of Gethsemane, Gethsemane was a, if you will, a grape press. That's really what it means. And this raises a question as well, because Jesus is praying, and then the individuals that come to take him, the temple guard, you get the sense usually that Jesus didn't know they were coming other than he was omniscient, until you go and look at where it was. There is a look from the Garden of Gethsemane to the Temple Mount, and those two areas in the top there are closed up. But at that time, the temple guards coming to Jesus would have come down through the Kidron Valley here. Here's another better picture of it here, to this area, the Garden of Gethsemane. What time did they come? At night. That means when Jesus is praying, when Peter is there, he can look up and he can see. They didn't have flashlights. What did they have? They had torches. He can see the torches coming to him, and he recognizes that they are coming to see him. Now, there are times when they wanted to try to kill him, and Jesus just walks through the crowd, or he leaves. You know, if Jesus had not been willing to give himself up, in that Garden of Gethsemane, he could have just gone right up the Mountain of Olives over to his friends in Bethany. That's Mary and Martha and Lazarus. Or he could have gone through the Kidron Valley the other way, and they would never have caught him. And so it wasn't until we got there that we realized that Jesus could see the lights coming for him. And that was an insight that I'd never really picked up until we sit in the Garden of Gethsemane and realize the path they would have come to take him and to bring him into Caiaphas's house, which is the next thing that we learned on this trip that we'd never done before. Went to the house of Caiaphas. Turns out that because he also had a position of leadership, there was also a prison. And so when we went there, I did not realize how different the prison is. You know, if I say prison, you're thinking of a door opens up, right? And a dungeon like this. Not this one. This is looking down into this. You had to walk into this. This is just like a big, huge crafted hole under where the palace for Caiaphas was. In other words, he is actually lower down. I don't care if you're a mountain climber, you're not going to be able to get back up to that. And I'd never really realized that before. And interestingly enough, some of the Greek Orthodox churches have actually painted this on their churches. And that is a picture of Jesus with ropes around him being lowered in there. And so I'd never really thought about that before. Instead of coming into a prison with a door, you're lowered into what? A pit. And when you look at some of the scriptures talking about the pit, also think about what's in the pit down there. Like I said, there's no porta potty down there. Can you imagine what you're being lowered into and how awful and rank that is? And so this is where Jesus actually stayed before he was then taken to Pilate and he was whipped and eventually crucified. And so that was a perspective I'd never had before as well. Well, let's, if we can, go to the New Testament real quickly. And in the New Testament, we're going to spend just a few more minutes before we run out of time. And we see, first of all, that Paul has been traveling through all of Asia Minor. That would be up there on the right. I put a circle around Troas. And when he gets to Troas, we see in verses chapter 16 that he had been prevented from actually going to these other cities in Asia Minor, which would be present-day Turkey, as you can see right there. And so then, when they came through the region, verse 6, of Phrygia and Galatia, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia, and when they had come up to Mysia, they attempted to go into Bithynia, but the Spirit of Jesus did not allow them. So, passing to Mysia, they went to Troas. So now we're in Troas, where the circle is. And a vision appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia was standing there, urging him to say, "Come over to Macedonia and help us." And when Paul had seen the vision, immediately he sought to go into Macedonia, concluding that God had called him to preach the gospel to them. And so now, instead, in Paul's second missionary journey, he goes from Troas to Neapolis and now begins to establish churches in Philippi, in Thessalonica, in Berea, in Corinth. And if you think about it, a full third of the New Testament epistles happen from those churches, all because instead God says, don't go east, go west. And now this is the first time the gospel comes to Europe. in the Grecian area. And so we begin to see some of that. So let's look at some of the places. First of all, Philippi, verses 16, verses 11 and 40. I won't go through all of them right there. But as you go to Philippi, the first thing that you see is that he is able to talk to a woman by the name of Lydia. She's obviously very wealthy because she sells these purple goods. And we found out a little bit more about this. Comes from these little shells that they collect. If you collect 1,000 of them, you get enough to actually have purple dye to actually put purple on clothes. So you can imagine you are talking about something very expensive. And so she begins to believe, and she and her household, we got to see which is supposedly the traditional site of where she was baptized. I have some questions about that because there is the Via Ignatia that goes through that, and there's no bridge. So maybe the river moved or changed. But anyway, that seems to be at least the traditional spot of where she becomes a believer. And so we see that taking place. Then in Philippi, he is involved in doing a number of things, but one of those gets him in a fair amount of trouble because not only does he lead Lydia to the Lord, but then he's being beset by this slave girl who has this demon possession. He casts out the demon, and because of that, those who were making money off of the slave girl, most likely she was like a sex trafficked woman, now begin to bring him before the magistrates, and they beat him and put him in prison. Over in the upper corner here, that's the remains of most likely where that prison was. It's got multiple locations, multiple rooms, and all of the rest. We've been able to uncover parts of it. They're still digging to this very day. They're finding more and more of that there in Philippi. So actually see where he is. And interestingly enough, after he has been beaten severely, what are they doing at midnight? They're singing. Now, I don't know about you, but if somebody had beaten me with rods, these leaders are known as rod bearers. That's what the magistrate means. They actually whip you with these rods. At midnight, I'm just nursing my wounds, but I'm certainly not singing, but they are. And then there's an earthquake, and this is one of the things that has created some of the problem, because this is an earthquake fault. And so the door opens, and the Philippian jailer realizes they probably have escaped, and he's about ready to kill himself, and they say, "Stop." And they realize that they're there. He's been hearing them sing. And so what question does he ask? What must I do to be saved? And so now they've led not only Lydia and her household to the Lord, but they've now also led the jailer and his household to the Lord. Isn't that amazing? And we begin to see the beginnings of the church there in Philippi. And of course, there is exactly what it looks like. Well, then he moves down to Thessalonica, and while he is there, we can once again see some of that. We look over now at verse 17 real quickly here. While they're in Thessalonica, they're once again having all sorts of issues. Matter of fact, I was sharing with some of the individuals that if you think about it, when Paul shows up in a town, there's two things that happen. First, there's a revival. Then there's a riot. You know, and it's just amazing. And I've said that there's a story of an English bishop one time that said, you know, wherever Paul went, first there was a revival, then there was a riot. And wherever I go, they serve tea. But certainly that is the case. And here in Thessalonica, another riot breaking out. And this time they bring Jason, and they bring Jason before this tribunal and the Berea to actually, the Bema seat, to actually bring charges against him as well. And so we begin to see again some of the historical verification that all these things that Luke has been describing in the Gospel and of Luke, and especially in the book of Acts, every one of them now fit with all the archaeological discoveries that were being made. A couple more real quickly. Let's go to Berea. In Berea now we see that Paul has spent a fair amount of time looking for someone that can give them comfort, and indeed finds that in some believers that actually were those who were in this church. This is the synagogue that was built on top of the synagogue that existed at the time when Paul was there. Some of these were destroyed by the Romans but then rebuilt, and that synagogue exists to this very day. And so we see exactly where Paul was. But we also see how they had comforted him and recognized that surrounding this are a number of houses all built together. There's only one entrance in and one entrance out. And what they did was create what today we call a ghetto. Back then, the ghetto meant a positive. Today, ghetto means a negative. But back then, it was so that they could protect the synagogue and protect all the Jews, later the Christians, who were in that area. And so now we see the establishment of the church in what? Berea. I thought it was kind of fun because when we went, oh, I guess I don't have the picture there. I had a picture of one of those places where it had a little plaque and it talked about the Bereans who were willing to what? Examine the scriptures daily to see if what Paul taught was so. That's the name of our class, the Examine. And I forgot to put that slide in there, but nevertheless, a great picture of this. But something else that I'd never picked up on, if you read about what they did in Berea, it talks about the fact that some of them conducted Paul as far as Athens. Well, let me tell you, I was on the bus for a better part of 2 days, although we stopped along the way, to get from Athens to Berea. So you got to think about this. Here are these individuals, Jews who've now become Christians, who are now developing a church, who are probably living on subsistence wages, who say, okay, I'll just give up the better part of a week or two to maybe get on a boat and take Paul all the way down to Athens. Isn't that interesting? And so again, it shows the sacrifice of the Bereans. And also, who were the ones that were most generous in giving to those in Jerusalem? Well, they're the Bereans. So again, we have a lot of linkage, if you will, with the title of our class, the Examine class, and the Bereans. Well, let's finally go to Athens. And here in verse 17, we have a situation in which, again, Paul is becoming very disturbed. Because it's while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. And then verse 17, for he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons in the marketplace every day, but some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, what does this babbler wish to say? Others said, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, known as Mars Hill, saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting. So here he finds himself now in Athens. What does he see? Well, first of all, he sees the Parthenon. He sees the Acropolis, this incredible structure that was built as a temple to the great Greek gods. And in the midst of this, he is now brought to a second place, and that is Mars Hill. And there's where Suzanne and I are standing on Mars Hill, which is where he was preaching. But look in the background, you can also see the Acropolis and the Parthenon. That's going to be important in just a minute. Because first of all, they call him a babbler. Well, the Greek for that is spermologos, which means a seed picker. Now, if you ever watch a bird, they'll pick up seeds, you know. Or if you ever seen a homeless person, they'll pick up various food that they'll see, or maybe a thrown away cigarette butt. That's what they're saying he is. He's kind of a seed picker. Well, what we see is he turns from being a seed picker to a seed planter because he plants the scriptures. Now, interestingly enough, in the midst of this, this is something we had never really realized how close Mars Hill is to the Parthenon, because here now he begins to talk about the fact that, first of all, he says that you're very religious and that you are worshiping, but then he begins to talk about the fact that indeed we worship a God who is not made with human hands. Well, there used to be this huge statue of Athena up there in the Parthenon in gold, and it's reflecting in the sun. And while he's preaching, he's pointing back to that and saying, we worship the God of heaven, not a God idol made with human hands. Once again, you can see Paul's kind of poking their fingers. You're worshiping that thing up there on the Parthenon, up on the Acropolis, but we worship the creator of all of heaven and earth. And so I never really picked up on how, in a sense, while he is standing there, he's pointing to what at that time was the great architectural wonder of the world, the Parthenon. And you think about all of this, you've got to recognize that in their day, who was important? Well, it was Caesar. It was Nero, or even in Caesarea, it was Felix and Festus, and it was King Agrippa. And they'd say, Peter, Paul, who are they? They're nothing. And yet Paul's standing there saying, what you think is so great is really very insignificant. And today we sort of figured that out, haven't we? because we call our children Peter and James and John. We call our dogs Caesar and Nero. If you want to learn a little bit more, here's some resources. I'll talk about Corinth real quickly, just to mention one more. It goes down, obviously, to Corinth, and here's another one of those examples which proves that Luke was right, because this is actually, says Erastus. He talks about this in the gospel there about Corinth. We learn about Erastus. We recognize that he is a true person, and we actually find that, indeed, he is even referring to Gallio, who is the proconsul, who actually appears before the Bema seat, and that's the place of judgment. And so, again, when we look at this Bema seat, this is something I'd never noticed before, because one of the things that Paul does is he talks about when you're in front of the Bema seat, what do you have? Well, you have this idea of the judgment seat of Christ. And if you turn over to Romans 14 real quickly, you can see that he's helping them understand the fact that we will appear before the judgment seat of Christ. But in the context of Romans 14, he's also talking about another issue of judgment, and that is meat sacrificed to idols. Well, until I got there, I never realized it. Matter of fact, as I was teaching on this, I realized, wait a minute, I'm looking at the Bema seat, which was where Paul was brought for judgment and excused, and this time was not whipped and hit with rods. But right next to me, not even 20 yards from me, is where the meat, which was sacrificed from idols, was for sale. And I realized in Romans 14, he's on the one hand saying, here's the judgment seat of Christ, which will be like this judgment seat. But over here, when we talk about meat sacrificed to idols, the lesser brother doesn't have to eat meat, but you have Christian liberty to do so. And I realized for the first time as I looked at this that these two passages in Romans 14 all come together, and they're within 20 yards of each other. And until you go there, you never really understand some of that as well. There's a picture of us in front of the Bema seat, just to give you a little bit of an idea of its size. And then, of course, this is another place where you have all these incredible structures, which, again, for Paul, provided an opportunity to expand the gospel. In Corinth, you're in a very small isthmus, and so everybody in Greece, even from Egypt, would come through Corinth. You would think, well, they would just sail right across the Mediterranean. No, they wouldn't, because they might get lost. So they would follow along the coast. Lots of times they would put a ship on one side and drag the ship across the small isthmus to the other side. And so everybody in the Roman Empire came through Corinth. And so this is why he spent a year and a half in Corinth to establish the church, which spread the gospel all through Europe. And it all goes back to Acts 16, the Macedonian call. God said, I want you to go west, not east. And when he did, we today enjoy the gospel that was presented to us. Well, if you'd like to know a little bit more, some of the books that we recommended on our tour are ones that are very available. Peter Walker wrote one called In the Steps of Jesus. It will really kind of take you through some of the history and archaeology of what we see in the Holy Land. And then we have one called In the Steps of St. Paul. And these are both, I think, Zondervan books, fairly available. But these were some resources I thought would be very helpful. And if nothing else, as you can tell, we're very excited about the trip. But more importantly, even if you didn't have a chance to go on the trip, you got a chance to learn some of the things we learned there. And it's nothing like going to the land where Jesus walked and Paul walked to answer some of the questions you have when you're trying to answer these questions from a biblical point of view.